Part 3. Scholar. Chapter 9. Garden of Sophia.
So he found out how many decks there are. What can he possibly do with that information?
Yes, that's the exact question. What was he planning that he felt it necessary to find that out? Nobody else even looked for that in the whole history of this school.
You think he's plotting revolution?
All we know about this kid is that he survived on the streets of Rotterdam. It's a hellish place from what I hear. The kids are vicious. They make Lord of the Flies look like Pollyanna.
When did you read Pollyanna?
It was a book.
How can he plot a revolution? He doesn't have any friends.
I never said anything about revolution. That's your theory.
I don't have a theory. I don't understand this kid. I never even wanted him up here. I think we should just send him home.
No.
No, sir, I'm sure you meant to say.
After 3 months in battle school, he figured out that defensive war makes no sense, and that we must have launched a fleet against the bugger homeworlds right after the end of the last war.
He knows that? And you come telling me he knows how many decks there are?
He doesn't know it. He guessed. I told him he was wrong.
Oh, I'm sure he believed you.
I'm sure he's in doubt.
This is all the more reason to send him back to Earth, or out to some distant base somewhere. Do you realize the nightmare if there's a breach of security on this?
Everything depends on how he uses the information.
Only we don't know anything about him, so we have no way of knowing how he'll use it.
Sister Carlotta...
Do you hate me? That woman is even more inscrutable than your little dwarf.
A mind like Bean's is not to be thrown away just because we fear there might be a security breach.
Nor is security to be thrown away for the sake of one really smart kid.
Aren't we smart enough to create new layers of deception for him? Let him find out something that he'll think is the truth. All we have to do is come up with a lie that we think he'll believe.
Sister Carlotta sat in the terrace garden, across the tiny table from the wizened old exile. "I'm just an old Russian scientist, living out the last years of his life on the shores of the Black Sea." Anton took a long drag on his cigarette and blew it out over the railing, adding it to the pollution flowing from Sophia out over the water. "I'm not here with any law enforcement authority," said Sister Carlotta.
"You have something much more dangerous to me. You are from the fleet."
"You're in no danger."
"That's true, but only because I'm not going to tell you anything.
Thank you for your candor."
"You value candor, but I don't think you would appreciate it if I told you the thoughts your body arouses in the mind of this old Russian."
"Trying to shock nuns is not much sport. There is no trophy."
"So, you take nunitude seriously?"
Sister Carlotta sighed. "You think I came here because I know something about you, and you don't want me to find out more. But I came here because of what I can't find out about you."
"Which is?"
"Anything. Because I was researching a particular matter for the IF, they gave me a summary of articles on the topic of research into altering the human genome."
"And my name came up?"
"On the contrary, your name was never mentioned."
"How quickly they forget."
"But when I read the few papers available from the people they did mention, always early work, before the IF security machine clamped down on them, I noticed a trend. Your name was always cited in their footnotes, cited constantly, and yet not a word of yours could be found, not even abstracts of papers. Apparently you have never published."
"And yet they quote me."
"Almost miraculous, isn't it? You people do collect miracles, don't you? To make saints?" no beatification until after you're dead. Sorry.
I have only one lung left as it is, said Anton. So I don't have that long to wait, as long as I keep smoking.
You could stop.
With only one lung, it takes twice as many cigarettes to get the same nicotine. Therefore, I have had to increase my smoking, not cut down. This should be obvious, but then you do not think like a scientist. You think like a woman of faith. You think like an obedient person. When you find out something is bad, you don't do it.
Your research was into genetic limitations on human intelligence.
Was it?
Because it's in that area that you are always cited. Of course, these papers were never about that exact subject, or they too would have been classified. But the titles of the articles mentioned in the footnotes, the ones you never wrote since you never published anything, are all tied to that area.
It is so easy in a career to find oneself in a rut.
So I want to ask you a hypothetical question.
My favorite kind. Next to rhetorical ones. I can nap equally well through either kind.
Suppose someone were to break the law and attempt to alter the human genome, specifically to enhance intelligence.
Then someone would be in serious danger of being caught and punished.
Suppose that, using the best available research, he found certain genes that he could alter in an embryo that would enhance the intelligence of the person when he was born.
Embryo? Are you testing me? Such changes can only happen in the egg, a single cell.
And suppose a child was born with these alterations in place. The child was born, and he grew up enough for his great intelligence to be noticed.
I assume you are not speaking of your own child.
I'm speaking of no child at all, a hypothetical child. How would someone recognize that this child had been genetically altered? Without actually examining the genes.
Anton shrugged. What does it matter if you examine the genes? They will be normal.
Even though you altered them?
It is such a little change. Hypothetically speaking.
Within the normal range of variation?
It is two switches. One that you turn on. One that you turn off. The gene is already there, you see.
What gene?
Savants were the key for me. Autistic, usually. Dysfunctional. They have extraordinary mental powers. Lightning-fast calculations. Phenomenal memories. But they are inept. Even retarded in other areas. Square roots of 12-digit numbers in seconds, but incapable of conducting a simple purchase in a store. How can they be so brilliant and so stupid?
That gene?
No. It was another. But it showed me what was possible. The human brain could be far smarter than it is. But is there a, how you say, bargain?
Trade-off.
A terrible bargain. To have this great intellect, you have to give up everything else. That's how the brains of autistic savants accomplish such feats. They do one thing, and the rest is a distraction, an annoyance, beyond the reach of any conceivable interest. Their attention truly is undivided.
So all hyperintelligent people would be retarded in some other way.
That is what we all assumed, because that is what we saw. The exceptions seemed to be only mild savants, who were thus able to spare some concentration on ordinary life. Then I thought... But I can't tell you what I thought, because I have been served with an order of inhibition.
He smiled helplessly. Sister Carlotta's heart fell. When someone was a proven security risk, they implanted in his brain a device that caused any kind of anxiety to launch a feedback loop, leading to a panic attack. Such people were then given periodic sensitization to make sure that they felt a great deal of anxiety when they contemplated talking about the forbidden subject. Viewed one way, it was a monstrous intrusion on a person's life. But if it was compared to the common practice of imprisoning or killing people who could not be trusted with a vital secret, an order of intervention could look downright humane. That explained, of course, why Anton was amused by everything. He had to be. If he allowed himself to become agitated or angry, any strong negative emotion, really, then he would have a panic attack, even without talking about forbidden subjects. Sister Carlotta had read an article once in which the wife of a man equipped with such a device said that their life together had never been happier, because now he took everything so calmly, with good humor. The children love him now, instead of dreading his time at home. She said that, according to the article, only hours before he threw himself from a cliff. Life was better, apparently, for everyone but him. And now she had met a man whose very memories had been rendered inaccessible.
What a shame, said Sister Carlotta.
But stay. My life here is a lonely one. You're a sister of mercy, aren't you? Have mercy on a lonely old man, and walk with me.
She wanted to say no, to leave at once. At that moment, however, he leaned back in his chair and began to breathe deeply, regularly, with his eyes closed, as he hummed a little tune to himself, a ritual of calming. So, at the very moment of inviting her to walk with him, he had felt some kind of anxiety that triggered the device. That meant there was something important about his invitation.
Of course I'll walk with you, she said.
Though technically my order is relatively unconcerned with mercy to individuals, we are far more pretentious than that. Our business is trying to save the world. He chuckled. One person at a time would be too slow. Is that it?
We make our lives of service to the larger causes of humanity. The Savior already died for sin. We work on trying to clean up the consequences of sin on other people.
An interesting religious quest, said Anton. I wonder whether my old line of research would have been considered a service to humanity, or just another mess that someone like you would have to clean up.
I wonder that myself, said Sister Carlotta.
We will never know.
They strolled out of the garden into the alley behind the house, and then to a street, and across it, and onto a path that led through an unattended park.
The trees here are very old, Sister Carlotta observed.
How old are you, Carlotta? Objectively or subjectively? Stick to the Gregorian calendar, please. As most recently revised.
That switch away from the Julian system still sticks in the Russian craw, does it?
It forced us for more than 7 decades to commemorate an October Revolution that actually occurred in November.
You are much too young to remember when there were communists in Russia.
On the contrary, I am old enough now to have all the memories of my people locked within my head. I remember things that happened long before I was born. I remember things that never happened at all. I live in memory.
Is that a pleasant place to dwell?
Pleasant? He shrugged. I laugh at all of it because I must. Because it is so sweetly said. All the tragedies. And yet, nothing is learned.
Because human nature never changes, she said.
I have imagined, he said, how God might have done better when he made man. In his own image, I believe.
Male and female created he them. Making his image anatomically vague, one must suppose. He laughed and clapped her rather too forcefully on the back.
I didn't know you could laugh about such things. I am pleasantly surprised.
I'm glad I could bring cheer into your bleak existence.
And then you sink the barb into the flesh.
They reached an overlook that had rather less of a view of the sea than Anton's own terrace.
It is not a bleak existence, Carlotta. For I can celebrate God's great compromise in making human beings as we are.
Compromise?
Our bodies could live forever, you know. We don't have to wear out. Our cells are all alive. They can maintain and repair themselves, or be replaced by fresh ones. There are even mechanisms to keep replenishing our bones. Menopause need not stop a woman from bearing children. Our brains need not decay, shedding memories or failing to absorb new ones. But God made us with death inside.
You are beginning to sound serious about God.
God made us with death inside, and also with intelligence. We have our 70 years or so, perhaps 90 with care. In the mountains of Georgia, 130 is not unheard of, though I personally believe they are all liars. They would claim to be immortal if they thought they could get away with it. We could live forever, if we were willing to be stupid the whole time.
Surely you're not saying that God had to choose between long life and intelligence for human beings.
It's there in your own Bible, Carlotta. Two trees, knowledge and life. You eat of the tree of knowledge, and you will surely die. You eat of the tree of life, and you remain a child in the garden forever, undying.
You speak in theological terms, and yet I thought you were an unbeliever.
Theology is a joke to me. Amusing. I laugh at it. I can tell amusing stories about theology to jest with believers. You see, it pleases me and keeps me calm.
At last she understood. How clearly did he have to spell it out? He was telling her the information she asked about, but doing it in code, in a way that fooled not only any eavesdroppers, and there might well be listeners to every word they said, but even his own mind. It was all a jest. Therefore he could tell her the truth, as long as he did it in this form.
Then I don't mind hearing your wild humorous forays into theology.
Genesis tells us of men who live to be more than 900 years old. What it does not tell you is how very stupid these men all were.
Sister Carlotta laughed aloud.
That's why God had to destroy humanity with his little flood,
Anton went on.
Get rid of those stupid people and replace them with quicker ones. Quick, quick, quick. Their minds moved, their metabolism, rushing onward into the grave.
From Methuselah at nearly a millennium of life, to Moses with his 120 years, and now to us. But our lives are getting longer.
I rest my case.
Are we stupider now?
So stupid that we would rather have long life for our children than see them become too much like God, knowing good and evil, knowing everything.
He clutched at his chest, gasping.
Oh, God! God in heaven!
He sank to his knees. His breath was shallow and rapid now. His eyes rolled back in his head. He fell over. Apparently, he hadn't been able to maintain his self-deception. His body finally caught on to how he had managed to tell his secret to this woman by speaking it in the language of religion. She rolled him onto his back. Now that he had fainted, his panic attack was subsiding. Not that fainting was trivial in a man of Anton's age, but he would not need any heroism to bring him back, not this time. He would wake up calm. Where were the people who were supposed to be monitoring him? Where were the spies who were listening in to their conversation? Pounding feet on the grass, on the leaves.
A bit slow, weren't you? She said without looking up.
Sorry, we didn't expect anything. The man was youngish, but not terribly bright-looking. The implant was supposed to keep him from spilling his tail. It was not necessary for his guards to be clever.
I think he'll be all right.
What were you talking about?
Religion, she said, knowing that her account would probably be checked against a recording. He was criticizing God for mismaking human beings. He claimed to be joking, but I think that a man of his age is never really joking when he talks about God. Do you?
Fear of death gets in them, said the young man sagely, or at least as sagely as he could manage.
Do you think he accidentally triggered this panic attack by agitating his own anxiety about death? If she asked it as a question, it wasn't actually a lie, was it?
I don't know.
He's coming around. Well, I certainly don't want to cause him any more anxiety about religious matters. When he wakes up, tell him how grateful I am for our conversation. Assure him that he has clarified for me one of the great questions about God's purpose.
Yes, I'll tell him, said the young man earnestly.
Of course, he would garble the message hopelessly.
Sister Carlotta bent over and kissed Anton's cold, sweaty forehead. Then she rose to her feet and walked away. So that was the secret. The genome that allowed a human being to have extraordinary intelligence acted by speeding up many bodily processes. The mind worked faster. The child developed faster. Bean was indeed the product of an experiment in unlocking the savant gene. He had been given the fruit of the tree of knowledge. But there was a price. He would not be able to taste of the tree of life. Whatever he did with his life, he would have to do it young, because he would not live to be old. Anton had not done the experiment. He had not played God, bringing forth human beings who would live in an explosion of intelligence, sudden fireworks instead of single long-burning candles. But he had found a key God had hidden in the human genome. Someone else, some follower,
some insatiably curious soul, some would-be visionary longing to take human beings to the next stage of evolution, or some other such mad, arrogant cause. This someone had taken the bold step of turning that key, opening that door, putting the killing, brilliant fruit into the hand of Eve. And because of that act, that serpentine, slithering crime, it was Bean who had been expelled from the garden. Bean, who would now, surely, die. But die like a god, knowing good and evil.
Chapter 10. Sneaky.
I can't help you. You didn't give me the information I asked for.
We gave you the damned summaries.
You gave me nothing, and you know it. And now you come to me asking me to evaluate Bean for you? But you don't tell me why. You give me no context. You expect an answer, but you deprive me of the means of providing it.
Frustrating, isn't it?
Not for me. I simply won't give you any answer.
Then Bean is out of the program.
If your mind is made up, no answer of mine will change you, especially because you have made certain my answer will be unreliable.
You know more than you've told me, and I must have it.
How marvelous. You have achieved perfect empathy with me, for that is the exact statement I have repeatedly made to you.
An eye for an eye? How Christian of you.
Unbelievers always want other people to act like Christians.
Perhaps you haven't heard, but there's a war on.
Again, I could have said the same thing to you. There's a war on, yet you fence me around with foolish secrecy. Since there is no evidence of the formic enemy spying on us, this secrecy is not about the war. It's about the triumvirate maintaining their power over humanity. And I am not remotely interested in that.
You're wrong. That information is secret in order to prevent some terrible experiments from being performed.
Only a fool closes the door when the wolf is already inside the barn.
Do you have proof that Bean is the result of a genetic experiment?
How can I prove it when you have cut me off from all evidence? Besides, what matters is not whether he has altered genes, but what those genetic changes, if he has them, might lead him to do. Your tests were all designed to allow you to predict the behavior of normal human beings. They may not apply to Bean.
If he's that unpredictable, then we can't rely on him. He's out.
What if he's the only one who can win the war? Do you drop him from the program then?
Bean didn't want to have much food in his body, not tonight. So he gave away almost all his food and turned in a clean tray long before anyone else was done. Let the nutritionist be suspicious. He had to have time alone in the barracks. The engineers had always located the intake at the top of the wall over the door into the corridor. Therefore, the air must flow into the room from the opposite end, where the extra bunks were unoccupied. Since he had not been able to see a vent just glancing around that end of the room, it had to be located under one of the lower bunks. He couldn't search for it when others would see him, because no one could be allowed to know that he was interested in the vents. Now, alone, he dropped to the floor and in moments was jimmying at the vent cover. It came off readily. He tried putting it back on, listening carefully for the level of noise that operation caused. Too much. The vent screen would have to stay off. He laid it on the floor beside the opening, but out of the way so he wouldn't accidentally bump into it in the darkness. Then, to be sure, he took it completely out from under that bunk and slid it under the one directly across. Done. He then resumed his normal activities. Until night. Until the breathing of the others told him that most, if not all, were asleep. Bean slept naked, as many of the boys did. His uniform would not give him away. They were told to wear their towels when going to and from the toilet in the night, so Bean assumed that it, too, could be tracked. So as Bean slid down from his bunk, he pulled his towel from its hook on the bunk frame and wrapped it around himself as he trotted to the door of the barracks. Nothing unusual. Toilet trips were allowed, if not encouraged, after lights out, and Bean had made it a point to take several such runs during his time in battle school. No pattern was being violated, and it was a good idea to make his first excursion with an empty bladder. When he came back, if anyone was awake, all they saw was a kid in a towel heading back to his bunk. But he walked past his bunk and quietly sat down and slid under the last bunk, where the uncovered vent awaited him. His towel remained on the floor under the bunk, so that if anyone woke enough to notice that Bean's bunk was empty, they would see that his towel was missing and assume he had gone to the toilet. It was no less painful this time, sliding into the vent, but once inside, Bean found that his exercise had paid off. He was able to slide down at an angle, always moving slowly enough to make no noise and to avoid snagging his skin on any protruding metal. He wanted no injuries he'd have to explain. In the utter darkness of the air duct, he had to keep his mental map of the station constantly in mind. The faint nightlight of each barracks cast only enough light into the air ducts to allow him to make out the location of each vent. But what mattered was not the location of the other barracks on this level. Bean had to get either up or down to a deck where teachers lived and worked. Judging from the amount of time it took Dymac to get to their barracks, the rare times that a quarrel demanded his attention, Bean assumed that his quarters were on another deck. And because Dymac always arrived breathing a little heavily, Bean also assumed it was a deck below their own level, not above. Dymac had to climb a ladder, not slide down a pole, to reach them. Nevertheless, Bean had no intention of going down first. He had to see whether he could successfully climb to a higher deck before getting himself potentially trapped on a lower one. So when he finally, after passing three barracks, came to a vertical shaft, he did not climb down. Instead, he probed the walls to see how much larger it was than the horizontals. It was much wider. Bean could not reach all the way across it, but it was only slightly deeper, front to back. That was good. As long as Bean didn't work too hard and sweat too much, friction between his skin and the front and back walls of the duct would allow him to inch his way upward. And in the vertical duct, he could face forward, giving his neck a much-needed respite from being perpetually turned to one side. Downward was almost harder than upward, because once he started sliding, it was harder to stop. He was also aware that the lower he went, the heavier he would become. And he had to keep checking the wall beside him, looking for another side duct. But he didn't have to find it by probing, after all. He could see the side duct, because there was light in both directions. The teachers didn't have the same lights-out rules as the students, and their quarters were smaller, so that vents came more frequently, spilling more light into the duct. In the first room, a teacher was awake and working at his desk. The trouble was that Bean, peering out of a vent screen near the floor, could not see a thing he was typing. It would be that way in all the rooms. The floor vents would not work for him. He had to get into the air intake system. Back to the vertical duct. The wind was coming from above, and so that was where he had to go if he was to cross over from one system to another. His only hope was that the duct system would have an access door before he reached the fans, and that he would be able to find it in the dark. Heading always into the wind, and finding himself noticeably lighter after climbing past seven decks, he finally reached a wider area with a small light strip. The fans were much louder, but he still wasn't near enough to see them. It didn't matter. He would be out of this wind. The access door was clearly marked. It also might be wired to sound an alarm if it was opened. But he doubted it. That was the kind of thing that was done in Rotterdam to guard against burglars. Burglary wasn't a serious problem on space stations. This door would only have been alarmed if all doors in the station were fitted with alarms. He'd find out soon enough. He opened the door, slipped out into a faintly lighted space, closed the door behind him. The structure of the station was visible here, the beams, the sections of metal plating. There were no solid surfaces. The room was also noticeably colder, and not just because he was out of the hot wind. Cold, hard space was on the other side of those curved plates. The furnaces might be located here, but the insulation was very good, and they had not bothered to pump much of that hot air into this space, relying instead on seepage to heat it. Bean hadn't been this cold since Rotterdam. But compared to wearing thin clothing in the winter streets with the wind off the North Sea, this was still almost balmy. It annoyed Bean that he had become so pampered here that he even cared about such a slight chill. And yet he couldn't keep himself from shivering a couple of times. Even in Rotterdam, he hadn't been naked. Following the ductwork, he climbed up the workmen's ladderways to the furnaces and then found the air intake ducts and followed them back down. It was easy to find an access door and enter the main vertical duct. Because the air in the intake system did not have to be under positive pressure, the ducts did not have to be so narrow. Also, this was the part of the system where dirt had to be caught and removed, so it was more important to maintain access. By the time air got past the furnaces, it was already as clean as it was ever going to get. So instead of shinnying up and down narrow shafts, Bean scrambled easily down a ladder, and in the low light still had no trouble reading the signs telling which deck each side opening led to. The side passages weren't really ducts at all. Instead, they consisted of the entire space between the ceiling of one corridor and the floor of the one above. All the wiring was here, and the water pipes. Hot, cold, sewer. And besides the strips of dim work lights, the space was frequently lighted by the vents on both sides of the space. Those same narrow strips of vent openings that Bean had seen from the floor below on his first excursion. Now he could see easily down into each teacher's quarters. He crept along, making as little noise as possible, a skill he had perfected prowling through Rotterdam. He quickly found what he was looking for, a teacher who was awake but not working at his desk. The man was not well known to Bean because he supervised an older group of launchees and did not teach any of the classes Bean was taking. He was heading for a shower. That meant he would come back to the room and perhaps would sign in again, allowing Bean to have a chance at getting both his login name and his password. No doubt the teachers changed passwords often, so whatever he got wouldn't last long. Moreover, it was always possible that attempting to use a teacher's password on a student desk might set off some kind of alarm. But Bean doubted it. The whole security system was designed to shut students out, to monitor student behavior. The teachers would not be so closely watched. They frequently worked on their desks at odd hours, and they also frequently signed on to student desks during the day to call on their more powerful tools to help solve a student's problem or give a student more personalized computer resources. Bean was reasonably sure that the risk of discovery was outweighed by the benefits of snagging a teacher's identity. While he waited, he heard voices a few rooms up. He wasn't quite close enough to make out the words. Did he dare risk missing the bather's return? Moments later, he was looking down into the quarters of Dymac himself. Interesting. He was talking to a man whose holographic image appeared in the air over his desk. Colonel Graff, Bean realized. The commandant of battle school. My strategy was simple enough, Graff was saying. I gave in and got her access to the stuff she wanted. She was right. I can't get good answers from her unless I let her see the data she's asking for. So did she give you any answers? No, too soon. But she gave me a very good question. Which is? Whether the boy is actually human. Oh, come on. Does she think he's a bugger larva in a human suit? Nothing to do with the buggers. Genetically enhanced. It would explain a lot. But still human, then. Isn't that debatable? The difference between humans and chimpanzees is genetically slight. Between humans and Neanderthals, it had to be minute. How much difference would it take for him to be a different species? Philosophically interesting, but in practical terms, we don't know what this kid will do. There's no data on his species. He's a primate, which suggests certain regularities, but we can't assume anything about his motivations that... Sir, with all due respect, he's still a kid. He's a human being. He's not some alien. That's precisely what we've got to find out before we determine how much we can rely on him. And that's why you are to watch him even more carefully. If you can't get him into the mind game, then find some other way to figure out what makes him tick. Because we can't use him until we know just how much we can rely on him. Interesting that they openly call it the mind game among themselves, thought Bean. Then he realized what they were saying. Can't get him into the mind game. As far as Bean knew, he was the only kid who didn't play the fantasy game. They were talking about him. New species. Genetically altered. Bean felt his heart pounding in his chest. What am I? Not just smart, but different. What about the breach of security? Dymac asked. That's the other thing. You've got to figure out what he knows, or at least how likely he is to spill it to any other kids. That's the greatest danger right now. Is the possibility of this kid being the commander we need great enough to balance the risk of breaching security and collapsing the program? I thought with Ender we had an all-or-nothing long-odds bet, but this one makes Ender look like a sure thing. I didn't think of you as a gambler, sir. I'm not. But sometimes you're forced into the game. I'm on it, sir. Encrypt everything you send me on him. No names. No discussions with other teachers beyond the normal. Contain this. Of course. If the only way we can beat the buggers is to replace ourselves with a new species, Dymac, then have we really saved humanity? One kid is not replacement of a species, said Dymac. Foot in the door. Camel's nose in the tent. Give them an inch. Them, sir? Yes. I'm paranoid and xenophobic. That's how I got this job. Cultivate those virtues and you too might rise to my lofty station. Dymac laughed. Graf didn't. His head disappeared from the display. Bean had the discipline to remember that he was waiting to get a password. He crept back to the bather's room. Still not back. What breach of security were they talking about? It must have been recent for them to be discussing it with such urgency. That meant it had to be Bean's conversation with Dymac about what was really going on with the battle school. And yet his guess that the battle had already happened could not be it, or Dymac and Graf would not be talking about how he might be the only way they could beat the buggers. If the buggers were still unbeaten, the breach of security had to be something else. It could still be that his earlier guess was partly right, and battle school existed as much to strip the earth of good commanders as to beat the buggers. Graf's and Dymac's fear might be that Bean would let other kids in on the secret. For some of them, at least, it might rekindle their loyalty to the nation or ethnic group or ideology of their parents. And since Bean had definitely been planning to probe the loyalties of other students over the next months and years, he now would have to be doubly cautious not to let his pattern of conversation attract the attention of the teachers. All he needed to know was which of the best and brightest kids had the strongest home loyalties. Of course, for that, Bean would need to figure out just how loyalty worked, so he would have some idea of how to weaken it or strengthen it, how to exploit it or turn it. But just because this first guess of Bean's could explain their words didn't mean it was right. And just because the final bugger war had not yet been fought didn't mean his initial guess was completely wrong. They might, for instance, have launched a fleet against the bugger homeworld years ago, but were still preparing commanders to fight off an invasion fleet now approaching Earth. In that case, the security breach Graf and Dymac feared was that Bean would frighten others by letting them know how urgent and dire the situation of humanity was. The irony was that of all the children Bean had ever known, none could keep a secret as well as he did. Not even Ashiel, for in refusing his share of Poke's bread, he had tipped his hand. Bean could keep a secret, but he also knew that sometimes you had to give some hint of what you knew in order to get more information. That was what had prompted Bean's conversation with Dymac. It was dangerous, but in the long run, if he could keep them from removing him from the school entirely in order to silence him, not to mention keeping them from killing him, he had learned more important information than he had given them. In the end, the only things they could learn from him were about himself. And what he learned from them was about everything else. A much larger pool of knowledge. Himself. That was their puzzle. Who he was. Silly to be concerned about whether he was human. What else could he be? He had never seen any child show any desire or emotion that he himself had not felt. The only difference was that Bean was stronger, and did not let his fleeting needs and passions control his actions. Did that make him alien? He was human. Only better. The teacher came back into the room. He hung up his damp towel, but even before he dressed, he sat back down and logged on. Bean watched his fingers move over the keys. It was so quick. A blur of keystrokes. He would have to replay the memory in his mind many times to make sure. But at least he had seen it. Nothing obstructed his view. Bean crawled back toward the vertical intake shaft. The evening's expedition had already taken as long as he dared. He needed his sleep, and every minute away increased the risk of chance discovery. In fact, he had been very lucky on this first foray through the ducts. To happen to hear Dymac and Graf conversing about him, to happen to watch a teacher who conveniently gave him a clear view of his login. For a moment it crossed Bean's mind that they might know he was in the air system, might even have staged all this for him to see what he'd do. It might be just one more experiment. No. It wasn't just luck that this teacher showed him the login. Bean had chosen to watch him because he was going to shower, because his desk was sitting on the table in such a way that Bean had a reasonable chance of seeing the login. It was an intelligent choice on Bean's part. He had gone with the best odds, and it paid off. As for Dymac and Graf, it might have been chance that he overheard them talking, but it was his own choice to move closer at once in order to hear. And come to think of it, he had chosen to go exploring in the ducts because of precisely the same event that had prompted Graf and Dymac to be so concerned. Nor was it a surprise that their conversation happened after lights out for the children. That's when things would have quieted down, and with duties done, there would be time for a conversation without Graf calling Dymac in for a special meeting, which might arouse questions in the minds of the other teachers. Not luck, really. Bean had made his own luck. He saw the login and overheard the conversation because he had made that quick decision to get into the intake system and acted on it at once. He had always made his own luck. Maybe that was something that went along with whatever genetic alteration Graf had found out about. She, they had said. She had raised the question of whether Bean was genetically human. Some woman who was searching for information, and Graf had given in, was letting her have access to facts that had been hidden from her. That meant that he would receive more answers from this woman as she began to use that new data. More answers about Bean's origins. Could it be Sister Carlotta who had doubted Bean's humanity? Sister Carlotta, who wept when he left her and went into space? Sister Carlotta, who loved him as a mother loves her child? How could she doubt him? If they wanted to find some inhuman human, some alien in a human suit, they ought to take a good long look at a nun who embraces a child as her own, and then goes around casting doubt about whether he's a real boy. The opposite of Pinocchio's fairy. She touches a real boy and turns him into something awful and fearful. It could not have been Sister Carlotta they were talking about. Just another woman. His guess that it might be her was simply wrong, just like his guess that the final battle with the buggers had already happened. That's why Bean never fully trusted his own guesses. He acted on them, but always kept himself open to the possibility that his interpretations might be wrong. Besides, his problem was not figuring out whether he really was human or not. Whatever he was himself, and must act in such a way as to not only stay alive, but also get as much control over his own future as possible. The only danger to him was that they were concerned about the issue of his possible genetic alteration. Bean's task was therefore to appear so normal that their fears on that score would be dispelled. But how could he pretend to be normal? He hadn't been brought here because he was normal. He was brought here because he was extraordinary. For that matter, so were all the other kids. And the school put so much strain on them that some became downright odd. Like Bonzo Madrid, with his loud vendetta against Ender Wiggin. So, in fact, Bean shouldn't appear normal. He should appear weird in the expected ways. Impossible to fake that. He didn't know yet what signs the teachers were looking for in the behavior of the children here. He could find 10 things to do and do them, never guessing that there were 90 things he hadn't noticed. No. What he had to do was not to act in predictable ways, but to become what they hoped their perfect commander would be. When he got back to his barracks, climbed back up to his bunk, and checked the time on his desk, he found that he had done it all in less than an hour. He put away his desk and lay there replaying in his mind the image in his memory of the teacher's fingers logging in. When he was reasonably certain of what the login and password were, he allowed himself to drift toward sleep. Only then, as he was beginning to doze, did he realize what his perfect camouflage would be, quelling their fears and bringing him both safety and advancement. He had to become Ender Wiggin.
Chapter 11. Daddy.
Sir, I asked for a private interview.
Dymac is here because your breach of security affects his work.
Breach of security? This is why you reassigned me?
There is a child who used your login to the master teacher system. He found the login record files and rewrote them to give himself an identity.
Sir, I have faithfully adhered to all regulations. I never sign on in front of the students.
Everyone says they never sign on, but then it turns out they do.
Excuse me, sir, but Upana does not. He's always on the others when he catches them doing it. Actually, he's kind of anal about it. Drives us all crazy.
You can check my login records. I never sign on during teaching hours. In fact, I never sign on outside my quarters.
Then how could this child possibly get in using your login?
My desk sits on my table, like so. If I may use your desk to demonstrate.
Of course.
I sit like so. I keep my back to the door so no one can even see in. I never sign on in any other position.
Well, it's not like there's a window he can peek through.
Yes, it is, sir.
Dymac?
There is a window, sir. Look, the vent.
Are you seriously suggesting that he could...
He's the smallest child who ever...
It was that little Bean child who got my login?
Excellent, Dymac. You've managed to let his name slip out, haven't you?
I'm sorry, sir.
Ah, another security breach. Will you send Dymac home with me?
I'm not sending anybody home.
Sir, I must point out that Bean's intrusion into the master-teacher system is an excellent opportunity.
To have a student romping through the student data files?
To study Bean. We don't have him in the fantasy game, but now we have the game he chooses to play. We watch where he goes in the system, what he does with this power he has created for himself.
But the damage he can do is...
He won't do any damage, sir. He won't do anything to give himself away. This kid is too street smart. It's information he wants. He'll look, not touch.
So you've got him analyzed already, is that it? You know what he's doing at all times.
I know that if there's a story we really want him to believe, he has to discover it himself. He has to steal it from us. So I think this little security breach is the perfect way to heal a much more important one.
What I'm wondering is, if he's been crawling through the ducts, what else has he heard?
If we close off the duct system, he'll know he was caught. And then he won't trust what we set up for him to find.
So I have to permit a child to crawl around through the ductwork and...
He can't do it much longer. He's growing and the ducts are extremely shallow.
That's not much comfort right now. And unfortunately, we still have to kill Upanad for knowing too much.
Please assure me that you're joking.
Yes, I'm joking. You'll have him as a student soon enough, Captain Upanad. Watch him very carefully. Speak of him only with me. He's unpredictable and dangerous.
Dangerous? Little Bean.
He cleaned your clock, didn't he?
Yours too, sir. Begging your pardon.
Bean worked his way through every student at Battle School, reading the records of a half dozen or so per day. Their original scores, he found, were the least interesting thing about them. Everyone here had such high scores on all the tests given back on Earth that the differences were almost trivial. Bean's own scores were the highest, and the gap between him and the next highest, Ender Wiggin, was wide. As wide as the gap between Ender and the next child after him. But it was all relative. The difference between Ender and Bean amounted to half of a percentage point. Most of the children clustered between 97% and 98%. Of course, Bean knew what they could not know, that for him, getting the highest possible score on the tests had been easy. He could have done more, he could have done better, but he had reached the boundary of what the test could discover. The gap between him and Ender was much wider than they supposed. And yet, in reading the records, Bean came to see that the scores were merely a guide to a child's potential. The teachers talked most about things like cleverness, insight, intuition, the ability to develop rapport, to outguess an opponent, the courage to act boldly, the caution to make certain before committing, the wisdom to know which course was the appropriate one. And in considering this, Bean realized that he was not necessarily any better at these things than the other students. Ender Wiggin really did know things that Bean did not know. Bean might have thought to do as Wiggin did, arranging extra practices to make up for being with a commander who wouldn't train him. Bean even might have tried to bring in a few other students to train with him, since many things could not be done alone. But Wiggin had taken all comers, no matter how difficult it became to practice with so many in the battle room, and according to the teacher's notes, he spent more time now training others than in working on his own technique. Of course, that was partly because he was no longer in Bonzo Madrid's army, so he got to take part in the regular practices. But he still kept working with the other kids, especially the eager launchies who wanted a head start before they were promoted into a regular army. Why? Is he doing what I'm doing? Studying the other students to prepare for a later war on Earth? Is he building some kind of network that reaches out into all the armies? Is he somehow mistraining them, so he can take advantage of their mistakes later? From what Bean heard about Wiggin from the kids in his launch group who attended those practices, he came to realize that it was something else entirely. Wiggin seemed really to care about the other kids doing their best. Did he need so badly for them to like him? Because it was working, if that's what he was trying for. They worshipped him. But there had to be more to it than some hunger for love. Bean couldn't get a handle on it. He found that the teacher's observations, while helpful, didn't really help him get inside Wiggin's head. For one thing, they kept the psychological observations from the mind games somewhere else that Bean didn't have access to. For another, the teachers couldn't really get into Wiggin's mind because they simply didn't think at his level. Bean did. But Bean's project wasn't to analyze Wiggin out of scientific curiosity, or to compete with him, or even to understand him. It was to make himself into the kind of child that the teachers would trust, would rely on, would regard as fully human. For that project, Wiggin was his teacher because Wiggin had already done what Bean needed to do. And Wiggin had done it without being perfect. without being, as far as Bean could tell, completely sane. Not that anyone was. But Wiggins' willingness to give up hours every day to training kids who could do nothing for him? The more Bean thought about it, the less sense it made. Wiggin was not building a network of supporters. Unlike Bean, he didn't have a perfect memory, so Bean was quite sure Wiggin was not compiling a mental dossier on every other kid in battle school. The kids he worked with were not the best and were often the most fearful and dependent of the launchies and of the losers in the regular armies. They came to him because they thought being in the same room with the soldier who was leading in the standings might bring some luck to them. But why did Wiggin keep giving his time to them? Why did Polk die for me? That was the same question. Bean knew it. He found several books about ethics in the library and called them up on his desk to read. He soon discovered that the only theories that explained altruism were bogus. The stupidest was the old sociobiological explanation of uncles dying for nephews. There were no blood ties in armies now, and people often died for strangers. Community theory was fine as far as it went. It explained why communities all honored sacrificial heroes in their stories and rituals, but it still didn't explain the heroes themselves. For that was what Bean saw in Wiggin. This was the hero at his root. Wiggin really does not care as much about himself as he does about these other kids who aren't worth 5 minutes of his time. And yet this may be the very trait that makes everyone focus on him. Maybe this is why in all those stories Sister Carlotta told him, Jesus always had a crowd around him. Maybe this is why I'm so afraid of Wiggin. Because he's the alien, not me. He's the unintelligible one, the unpredictable one. He's the one who doesn't do things for sensible, predictable reasons. I'm going to survive, and once you know that, there's nothing more to know about me. Him, though. He could do anything. The more he studied Wiggin, the more mysteries Bean uncovered. The more he determined to act like Wiggin until at some point he came to see the world as Wiggin saw it. But even as he tracked Wiggin, still from a distance, what Bean could not let himself do was what the younger kids did, what Wiggin's disciples did. He could not call him Ender. Calling him by his last name kept him at a distance. A microscope's distance, anyway. What did Wiggin study when he read on his own? Not the books of military history and strategy that Bean had blown through in a rush and was now rereading methodically, applying everything to both space combat and modern warfare on Earth. Wiggin did his share of reading, too, but when he went into the library, he was just as likely to look at combat vids, and the ones he watched most often were of bugger ships. Those, and the clips of Mazer Rackham's strike force in the heroic battle that broke the back of the second invasion. Bean watched them too, though not over and over again. Once he saw them, he remembered them perfectly and could replay them in his mind, with enough detail that he could notice things later that he hadn't realized at first. Was Wiggin seeing something new each time he went back to these vids? Or was he looking for something that he hadn't yet found? Is he trying to understand the way the buggers think? Why doesn't he realize that the library here simply doesn't have enough of the vids to make it useful? It's all propaganda stuff here. They withheld all the terrible scenes of dead guys, of fighting and killing hand to hand when ships were breached and boarded. They didn't have vids of defeats where the buggers blew the human ships out of the sky. All they had here was ships moving around in space, a few minutes of preparation for combat. War in space? So exciting in the made-up stories, so boring in reality. Occasionally something would light up. Mostly it was just dark. And, of course, the obligatory moment of Mazer Rackham's victory. What could Wiggin possibly hope to learn? Bean learned more from the omissions than from what he actually saw. For instance, there was not one picture of Mazer Rackham anywhere in the library. That was odd. The triumvirate's faces were everywhere, as were those of other commanders and political leaders. Why not Rackham? Had he died in the moment of victory? Or was he perhaps a fictitious figure, a deliberately created legend so that there could be a name to peg the victory to? But if that were the case, they'd have created a face for him. It was too easy to do that. Was he deformed? Was he really, really small? If I grow up to be the commander of the human fleet that defeats the buggers, will they hide my picture too, because someone so tiny can never be seen as a hero? Who cares? I don't want to be a hero. That's Wiggins' gig. Nikolai, the boy across from him. Bright enough to make some guesses Bean hadn't made first. Confident enough not to get angry when he caught Bean intruding on him. Bean was so hopeful when he came at last to Nikolai's file. The teacher evaluation was negative. A placeholder. Cruel. But was it true? Bean realized, I have been putting too much trust in the teacher's evaluations. Do I have any real evidence that they're right? Or do I believe in their evaluations because I am rated so highly? Have I let them flatter me into complacency? What if all their evaluations were hopelessly wrong? I had no teacher files on the streets of Rotterdam. I actually knew the children. Poke. I made my own judgment of her, and I was almost right. Just a few surprises here and there. Sergeant? No surprises at all. Ashiel? Yes, I knew him. So why have I stayed apart from the other students? Because they isolated me at first, and because I decided that the teachers had the power. But now I see that I was only partly right. The teachers have the power here and now, but someday I will not be in battle school, and what does it matter then what the teachers think of me? I can learn all the military theory and history that I want, and it will do me no good if they never entrust me with command. And I will never be placed in charge of an army or a fleet unless they have reason to believe that other men would follow me. Not men today, but boys, most of them. A few girls. Not men, but they will be men. How do they choose their leaders? How do I make them follow one who is so small, so resented? What did Wigan do? Bean asked Nikolai which of the kids in their launch group practiced with Wigan. Only a few. And they on the fringes, ne? Suck-ups and brags. But who are they? You trying to get in with Wigan? Just want to find out about him. What do you want to know? The questions bothered Bean. He didn't like talking so much about what he was doing. But he didn't sense any malice in Nikolai. He just wanted to know. History. He the best, ne? How we get that way? Bean wondered if he sounded quite natural with the soldier slang. He hadn't used it that much. The music of it, he still wasn't quite there. You find out, you tell me. He rolled his eyes in self-derision. I'll tell you, said Bean. I got a chance to be best like Ender? Nikolai laughed. You got a chance the way you learn. Wiggins' snot ain't honey, said Bean. What does that mean? He human like anybody. I find out, I tell you, okay? Bean wondered why Nikolai already despaired about his own chances of being one of the best. Could it be that the teacher's negative evaluation was right after all? Or had they unconsciously let him see their disdain for him, and he believed them? From the boys Nikolai had pointed out, the brags and suck-ups, which wasn't an inaccurate evaluation as far as it went, Bean learned what he wanted to know. The names of Wiggins' closest friends. Shen. Alai. Petra. Her again. But Shen the longest. Bean found him in the library during study time. The only reason to go there was for the vids. All the books could be read from the desks. Shen wasn't watching vids, though. He had his desk with him, and he was playing the fantasy game. Bean sat down beside him to watch. A lion-headed man in chainmail stood before a giant who seemed to be offering him a choice of drinks. The sound was shaped so that Bean couldn't hear it from beside the desk, though Shen seemed to be responding. He typed in a few words. His lion man figure drank one of the substances and promptly died. Shen muttered something and shoved the desk away. "That the giant's drink?" said Bean. "I heard about that." "You've never played it?" said Shen. "You can't win it, I thought. I heard. Didn't sound fun." "Sound fun? You haven't tried it? It's not like it's hard to find." Bean shrugged, trying to fake the mannerisms he'd seen other boys use. Shen looked amused. Because Bean did the cool guy shrug wrong? Or because it looked cute to have somebody so small do it? "Come on. You don't play the fantasy game?" "What you said," Bean prompted him. "You thought nobody ever won it." "I saw a guy in a place I'd never seen. I asked him where it was, and he said, 'Other side of the giant's drink.'"
"He tell you how to get there?"
"I didn't ask."
"Why not?"
Shen grinned, looked away.
"It be Wigan, eh?" asked Bean.
The grin faded. "I didn't say that."
"I know you're his friend, that's why I came here."
"What is this?
You spying on him? You from Bonso?"
This was not going well. Bean hadn't realized how protective Wigan's friends might be.
"I'm from me. Look, nothing bad, okay? I just want to know about... You know him from the start, right? They say you've been his friend from launchy days."
"So what?"
"Look, he got friends, right? Like you. Even though he always does better in class, always the best on everything, right? But they don't hate him."
"Plenty be chong hate him."
"I got to make some friends, man."
Bean knew that he shouldn't try to sound pitiful. Instead, he should sound like a pitiful kid who was trying really hard not to sound pitiful. So he ended his maudlin little plea with a laugh, as if he was trying to make it sound like a joke. "You're pretty short," said Shen.
"Not on the planet I'm from," said Bean.
For the first time, Shen let a genuine smile come to his face.
"The planet of the pygmies. Them boys too big for me."
"Look, I know what you're saying," said Shen.
"I had this funny walk. Some of the kids were ragging me. Ender stopped them."
"How?"
"Ragged them more."
"I never heard he got a mouth."
"No, he didn't say nada. Did it on the desk. Sent a message from God."
"Oh, yeah. Bean had heard about that. He did that for you?"
"They were making fun of my butt. I had a big butt. Before workouts, you know, back then. So he make fun of them for looking at my butt. But he signs it God."
"So they didn't know it was him?"
"Oh, they knew. Right away. But he didn't say anything. Out loud."
"That's how you got to be friends? He the protector of the little guys?"
"Like a shield."
"Little guys," said Shen. "He was the smallest in our launch group. Not like you, but way small. Younger, see?"
"He was youngest? But he became your protector?"
"No, not like that. No, he kept it from going on, that's all. He went to the group. It was Bernard. He was getting together the biggest guys, the tough guys, the bullies."
"Yeah, I guess."
"Only Ender, he goes to Bernard's number one, his best friend. A lie. He gets a lie to be his friend, too. So he stole away Bernard's support."
"No, man.
No, it's not like that. He made friends with a lie and then got a lie to help him make friends with Bernard."
"Bernard? He's the one Ender broke his arm in the shuttle." That's right. And I think, really, Bernard never forgave him. But he saw how things were.
How were things? Ender's good, man. He doesn't hate anybody. If you're a good person, you're going to like him. You want him to like you. If he likes you, then you're okay, see? But if you're scum, he just makes you mad. Just knowing he exists, see? So Ender, he tries to wake up the good part of you. How do you wake up good parts? I don't know, man. You think I know? It's just... You know Ender long enough, he just makes you want him to be proud of you. That sounds so... Sounds like I'm a baby, nah? Bean shook his head. What it sounded like to him was devotion. Bean hadn't really understood this. Friends were friends, he thought. Like Sergeant and Poke used to be, before Ashiel. But it was never love. When Ashiel came, they loved him, but it was more like worship, like a god. He got them bread. They gave bread back to him. Like, well, like what he called himself. Papa. Was it the same thing? Was Ender Ashiel all over again? You're smart, kid, said Shen. I was there, nah? Only I never once thought, how did Ender do it? How can I do the same, be like him? It's like that was Ender. He's great, but it's nothing I could do. Maybe I should have tried. I just wanted to be with him. Because you're good, too, said Bean. Shen rolled his eyes. I guess that's what I was saying, wasn't it? Implying, anyway. Guess that makes me a brag, nah? Big old brag, said Bean, grinning. He's just... He makes you want to... I'd die for him. That sounds like hero talk, nah? But it's true. I'd die for him. I'd kill for him. You'd fight for him. Shen got it at once. That's right. He's a born commander. Alai fight for him too? A lot of us. But some not, yes? Like I said, the bad ones, they hate him. He makes them crazy. So the whole world divides up. Good people love Wigan, bad people hate Wigan. Shen's face went suspicious again. I don't know why I told you all that, Merida. You too smart to believe any of it. I do believe it, said Bean. Don't be mad at me. He'd learned that one a long time ago. Little kid says, don't be mad at me, they feel a little silly. I'm not mad, said Shen. I just thought you were making fun of me. I wanted to know how Wigan makes friends. If I knew that, if I really understood that, I'd have more friends than I do, kid. But I got Ender as my friend, and all his friends are my friends, too, and I'm their friend, so it's like a family. A family. Papa. Ashiel again. That old dread returned. That night after Poke died. Seeing her body in the water. Then Ashiel in the morning. How he acted. Was that Wigan? Papa, until he got his chance? Ashiel was evil, and Ender was good. Yet they both created a family. Both had people who loved them, who would die for them. Protector, Papa. Provider, Mama. Only parent to a crowd of orphans. We're all street kids up here in battle school, too. We might not be hungry, but we're all still wishing for a family. Except me. Last thing I need. Some papa smiling at me, waiting with a knife. Better to be the papa than to have one. How can I do that? Get somebody to love me the way Shen loves Wigan. No chance. I'm too little. Too cute. I got nothing they want.
All I can do is protect myself, work the system. Ender's got plenty to teach those that have some hope of doing what he's done. But me? I have to learn my own way. Even as he made the decision, though, he knew he wasn't done with Wigan. Whatever Wigan had, whatever Wigan knew, Bean would learn it. And so passed the weeks, the months. Bean did all his regular classwork. He attended the regular battle room classes with Dymac, teaching them how to move and shoot, the basic skills. On his own, he completed all the enrichment courses you could take at your own desk, certifying in everything. He studied military history, philosophy, strategy. He read ethics, religion, biology. He kept track of every student in the school, from the newly arrived launchees to the students about to graduate. When he saw them in the halls, he knew more about them than they knew about themselves. He knew their nation of origin. He knew how much they missed their families and how important their native country or ethnic or religious group was to them. He knew how valuable they might be to a nationalist or idealist resistance movement. And he kept reading everything Wigan read, watching everything Wigan watched, hearing about Wigan from the other kids, watching Wigan's standings on the boards, meeting more of Wigan's friends, hearing them talk about him. Bean listened to all the things Wigan was quoted as saying and tried to fit them into some coherent philosophy, some worldview, some attitude, some plan. And he found out something interesting. Despite Wigan's altruism, despite his willingness to sacrifice, not one of his friends ever said that Wigan came and talked over his problems. They all went to Wigan, but who did Wigan go to? He had no more real friends than Bean did. Wigan kept his own counsel, just like Bean. Soon Bean found himself being advanced out of classes whose work he had already mastered and being plunged into classwork with older and older groups who looked at him with annoyance at first, but later simply with awe as he raced past them and was promoted again before they were half done. Had Wigan been pushed through his classwork at an accelerated rate? Yes, but not quite as fast. Was that because Bean was better? Or because the deadline was getting closer? For the sense of urgency in teacher evaluations was getting greater. The ordinary students, as if any child here were ordinary, were getting briefer and briefer notations. They weren't being ignored exactly, but the best were being identified and lifted out. The seeming best. For Bean began to realize that their evaluations were often colored by which students they liked the best. The teachers pretended to be dispassionate, impartial, but in fact they got sucked in by the more charismatic children, just as the other students did. If a kid was likable, they gave him better comments on leadership, even if he was really just glib and athletic and needed to surround himself with a team. As often as not, they tagged the very students who would be the least effective commanders, while ignoring the ones who, to Bean, showed real promise. It was frustrating to watch them make such obvious mistakes. Here they had Wigan right before their eyes. Wigan, who was the real thing. And they still went on misreading everybody else. Getting all excited about some of these energetic, self-confident, ambitious kids, even though they weren't actually producing excellent work. Wasn't this whole school set up in order to find and train the best possible commanders? The Earthside testing did pretty well. There were no real dolts among the students. But the system had overlooked one crucial factor. How were the teachers chosen? They were career military, all of them. Proven officers with real ability. But in the military, you don't get trusted positions just because of your ability. You also have to attract the notice of superior officers. You have to be liked. You have to fit in with the system. You have to look like what the officers above you think that officers should look like. You have to think in ways that they are comfortable with. The result was that you ended up with a command structure that was top-heavy with guys who looked good in uniform and talked right and did well enough not to embarrass themselves, while the really good ones quietly did all the serious work and bailed out their superiors and got blamed for errors they had advised against until they eventually got out. That was the military. These teachers were all the kind of people who thrived in that environment. And they were selecting their favorite students based on precisely that same screwed-up sense of priorities. No wonder a kid like Dink Meeker saw through it and refused to play. He was one of the few kids who was both likable and talented. His likability made them try to make him commander of his own army. His talent let him understand why they were doing it and turned them down because he couldn't believe in such a stupid system. And other kids, like Petra Arkanian, who had obnoxious personalities but could handle strategy and tactics in their sleep, who had the confidence to lead others into war, to trust their own decisions and act on them. They didn't care about trying to be one of the guys, and so they got overlooked. Every flaw became magnified, every strength belittled. So Bean began constructing his own anti-army. Kids who weren't getting picked out by the teachers, but were the real talents, the ones with heart and mind, not just face and chat. He began to imagine who among them should be officers, leading their own tunes under the command of Ender Wiggin, of course. Bean could not imagine anyone else in that position. Wiggin would know how to use them. And Bean knew just where he should be. Close to Wiggin. A toon leader, but the most trusted of them. Wiggin's right-hand man. So when Wiggin was about to make a mistake, Bean could point out to him the error he was making. And so that Bean could be close enough to maybe understand why Wiggin was human, and he himself was not.
Sister Carlotta used her new security clearance like a scalpel, most of the time, slicing her way into the information establishment, picking up answers here and new questions there, talking to people who never guessed what her project was, why she knew so much about their top-secret work, and quietly putting it all together in her own mind, in memos to Colonel Graff. But sometimes she wielded her top security clearance like a meat axe, using it to get past prison wardens and security officers, who saw her unbelievable level of need to know, and then, when they checked to make sure her documents weren't a stupid forgery, were screamed at by officers so high-ranked that it made them want to treat Sister Carlotta like God. That's how, at last, she came face to face with Bean's father, or at least the closest thing to a father that he had. "I want to talk to you about your installation in Rotterdam." He looked at her sourly. "I already reported on everything. That's why I'm not dead, though I wonder if I made the right choice." "They told me you were quite the whiner," said Sister Carlotta, utterly devoid of compassion. "I didn't expect it to surface so quickly." "Go to hell." He turned his back on her. As if that meant anything. "Dr. Valescu, the records show that you had 23 babies in your organ farm in Rotterdam." He said nothing. "But of course, that's a lie." Silence. "And, oddly enough, I know that the lie is not your idea. Because I know that your installation was not an organ farm indeed, and that the reason you aren't dead is because you agreed to plead guilty to running an organ farm in exchange for never discussing what you were really doing there." He slowly turned around again, enough that he could look up and see her with a sidelong glance. "Let me see that clearance you tried to show me before." She showed it to him again. He studied it. "What do you know?" he asked. "I know your real crime was continuing a research project after it was closed down. Because you had these fertilized eggs that had been meticulously altered. You had turned Anton's key. You wanted them to be born. You wanted to see who they would become. If you know all that, why have you come to me? Everything I knew is in the documents you must have read.
Not at all, said Sister Carlotta. I don't care about confessions. I don't care about logistics. I want to know about the babies.
They're all dead, he said. We killed them when we knew we were about to be discovered.
He looked at her with bitter defiance.
Yes, infanticide. 23 murders. But since the government couldn't admit that such children had ever existed, I was never charged with the crimes. God judges me, though. God will press the charges. Is that why you're here? Is that who gave you your clearance?
You make jokes about this? All I want to know is what you learned about them.
I learned nothing. There was no time. They were still babies.
You had them for almost a year. They developed. All the work done since Anton found his key was theoretical. You watched the babies grow.
A slow smile crept across his face. This is like those Nazi medical crimes all over again. You deplore what I did, but you still want to know the results of my research.
You monitored their growth, their health, their intellectual development.
We were about to start the tracking of intellectual development. The project wasn't funded, of course, so it's not as if we could provide much more than a clean, warm room and basic bodily needs.
Their bodies, then. Their motor skills.
Small, he said. They are born small. They grow slowly. Undersized and underweight, all of them.
But very bright.
Crawling, very young. Making pre-speech sounds far earlier than normal. That's all we knew. I didn't see them often myself. I couldn't afford the risk of detection.
So what was your prognosis?
Prognosis?
How did you see their future?
Dead. That's everyone's future. What are you talking about?
If they hadn't been slaughtered, Dr. Valescu, what would have happened?
They would have kept on growing, of course.
And later?
There is no later. They keep on growing.
She thought for a moment, trying to process the information.
That's right, sister. You're getting it. They grow slowly, but they never stop. That's what Anton's key does. Unlocks the mind because the brain never stops growing. But neither does anything else. The cranium keeps expanding. It's never fully closed. The arms and legs, longer and longer.
So when they reach adult height,
there is no adult height. There's just height at the time of death. You can't keep growing like that forever. There's a reason why evolution builds a stop clock into the growth control of long-lived bodies. You can't keep growing without some organ giving out eventually. Usually the heart.
The implications filled Sister Carlotta with dread.
And the rate of this growth? In the children, I mean? How long until they are at normal height for their age?
My guess was that they'd catch up twice, said Valescu. Once just before puberty, and then the normal kids would leap ahead for a while.
But slow and steady wins the race, n'est-ce pas? By 20, they would be giants. And then they'd die, almost certainly before age 25. Do you have any idea how huge they would be? So my killing them, you see. It was a mercy. I doubt any of them would have chosen to miss out on even the mere 20 years you took from them. They never knew what happened to them. I'm not a monster. We drugged them all. They died in their sleep, and then the bodies were incinerated.
What about puberty? Would they ever mature sexually?
That's the part we'll never know, isn't it?
Sister Carlotta got up to go.
He lived, didn't he? Asked Valescu.
Who?
The one we lost. The one whose body wasn't with the others. I counted only 22 going into the fire.
When you worship Moloch, Dr. Valescu, you get no answers but the ones your chosen god provides.
Tell me what he's like.
His eyes were so hungry. You know it was a boy?
They were all boys, said Valescu.
What, did you discard the girls?
How do you think I got the genes I worked with? I implanted my own altered DNA into denucleated eggs.
God help us. They were all your own twins?
I'm not the monster you think I am, said Valescu. I brought the frozen embryos to life because I had to know what they would become. Killing them was my greatest sorrow.
And yet you did it. To save yourself.
I was afraid. And the thought came to me, they're only copies. It isn't murder to discard the copies.
Their souls and lives were their own.
Do you think the government would have let them live? Do you really think they would have survived? Any of them?
You don't deserve to have a son, said Sister Carlotta.
But I have one, don't I? He laughed. While you, Miss Carlotta, perpetual bride of the invisible god, how many do you have?
They may have been copies, Valescu, but even dead they're worth more than the original. He continued laughing as she walked down the corridor away from him, but it sounded forced. She knew his laughter was a mask for grief. But it wasn't the grief of compassion, or even of remorse. It was the grief of a damned soul.
Bean.
God be thanked, she thought, that you do not know your father, and never will. You're nothing like him. You're far more human. In the back of her mind, though, she had one nagging doubt. Was she sure Bean had more compassion, more humanity? Or was Bean as cold of heart as this man, as incapable of empathy? Was he all mind? Then she thought of him growing and growing, from this too tiny child to a giant whose body could no longer sustain life. This was the legacy your father gave you. This was Anton's key. She thought of David's cry when he learned of the death of his son, Absalom. O Absalom, would God I could die for thee, Absalom my son. But he was not dead yet, was he? Valescu might have been lying. Might simply be wrong. There might be some way to prevent it. And even if there was not, there were still many years ahead of Bean. And how he lived those years still mattered. God raises up the children that he needs, and makes men and women of them, and then takes them from this world at his good pleasure. To him, all of life is but a moment. All that matters is what that moment was used for. And Bean would use it well. She was sure of that. Or, at least she hoped it with such fervor that it felt like certainty.
Chapter 12. Roster.
If Wiggins the one, then let's get him to Eros.
He's not ready for command school yet. It's premature.
Then we have to go with one of the alternates.
That's your decision.
Our decision. What do we have to go on but what you tell us?
I've told you about those older boys, too. You have the same data I have.
Do we have all of it?
Do you want all of it?
Do we have the data on all the children with scores and evaluations at such a high level?
No.
Why not?
Some of them are disqualified for various reasons.
Disqualified by whom?
By me.
On what grounds?
One of them is borderline insane, for instance. We're trying to find some structure in which his abilities will be useful. But he could not possibly bear the weight of complete command.
That's one.
Another is undergoing surgery to correct a physical defect.
Is it a defect that limits his ability to command?
It limits his ability to be trained to command.
But it's being fixed.
He's about to have his third operation. If it works, he might amount to something. But as you say, there won't be time.
How many more children have you concealed from us?
I have concealed none of them. If you mean how many have I simply not referred to you as potential commanders, the answer is all of them. Except the ones whose names you already have.
Let me be blunt. We hear rumors about a very young one.
They're all young.
We hear rumors about a child who makes the Wigan boy look slow.
They all have their different strengths.
There are those who want you relieved of your command.
If I'm not to be allowed to select and train these kids properly, I'd prefer to be relieved, sir. Consider this a request.
So it was a stupid threat. Advance them all as quickly as you can. Just keep in mind that they need a certain amount of time in command school, too. It does us no good to give them all your training if they don't have time to get ours.
Dymac met Graf in the Battle Room Control Center. Graf conducted all his secure meetings here until they could be sure Bean had grown enough that he couldn't get through the ducts. The battle rooms had their own separate air systems. Graf had an essay on his desk display. Have you read this? Problems in campaigning between solar systems separated by light years. It's been circulating pretty widely among the faculty. But it isn't signed, said Graf. You don't happen to know who wrote it, do you?
No, sir. Did you write it?
I'm no scholar, Dymac, you know that. In fact, this was written by a student.
At command school?
A student here. At that moment, Dymac understood why he had been called in.
Bean.
6 years old. The paper reads like a work of scholarship.
I should have guessed. He picks up the voice of the strategists he's been reading, or their translators, though I don't know what will happen now that he's been reading Frederick and Bülow in the original, French and German. He inhales languages and breathes them back out.
What did you think of this paper?
You already know it's killing me to keep key information from this boy. If he can write this with what he knows, what would happen if we told him everything? Colonel Graf, why can't we promote him right out of battle school, set him loose as a theorist, and then watch what he spits out?
Our job isn't to find theorists here. It's too late for theory anyway.
I just think, look, a kid so small, who'd follow him? He's being wasted here. But when he writes, nobody knows how little he is. Nobody knows how young he is.
I see your point, but we're not going to breach security, period.
Isn't he already a grave security risk?
The mouse who scutters through the ducts?
No, I think he's grown too big for that. He doesn't do those sidearm push-ups anymore.
I thought the security risk came from the fact that he guessed that an offensive fleet had been launched generations ago. So why were we still training children for command? From analysis of his papers, from his activities when he signs on as a teacher, we think he's got a theory and it's wonderfully wrong. But he believes his false theory only because he doesn't know about the Ansible. Do you understand? Because that's the main thing we'd have to tell him about, isn't it?
Of course.
So you see, that's the one thing we can't tell him.
What is his theory?
That we're assembling children here in preparation for a war between nations, or between nations and the IF, a landslide war back on Earth.
Why would we take the kids into space to prepare for a war on Earth?
Think just a minute, and you'll get it.
Because when we've licked the Formix, there probably will be a little landside conflict, and all the talented commanders, the IF would already have them. You see, we can't have this kid publishing, not even within the IF. Not everybody has given up loyalty to groups on Earth. So why did you call me in? Because I do want to use him. We aren't running the war here, but we are running a school. Did you read his paper about the ineffectiveness of using officers as teachers? Yes, I felt slapped. Now, this time he's mostly wrong because he has no way of knowing how non-traditional our recruitment of faculty has always been. But he may also be a little bit right. Because our system of testing for officer potential was designed to produce candidates with the traits identified in the most highly regarded officers in the second invasion. Hi-ho, you see? Some of the highly regarded were officers who performed well in battle, but the war was too short to weed out the deadwood. The officers they tested included just the kind of people he criticized in his paper. So he had the wrong reason, but the right result. Absolutely. It gives us little pricks like Bonzo Madrid. You've known officers like him, haven't you? So why should we be surprised that our tests give him command of an army, even though he has no idea what to do with it? All the vanity and all the stupidity of Custer or Hooker or, hell, pick your own vain incompetent. It's the most common kind of general officer. May I quote you? I'll deny it. The thing is, Bean has been studying the dossiers of all the other students. We think he's evaluating them for loyalty to their native identity group and also for their excellence as commanders. By his standards of excellence. We need to get Ender the command of an army. We're under a lot of pressure to get our leading candidates into command school. But if we bust one of the current commanders in order to make a place for Ender, it'll cause too much resentment. So you have to give him a new army. Dragon. There are still kids here who remember the last Dragon army. Right. I like that. The Jinx. I see. You want to give Ender a running start. It gets worse. I thought it would. We also aren't going to give him any soldiers that aren't already on their commander's transfer list. The dregs? What are you doing to this kid? If we choose them by our ordinary standards, then yes, the dregs. But we aren't going to choose Ender's army. Bean? Our tests are worthless on this, right? Some of those dregs are the very best students, according to Bean, right? And he's been studying the launchees. So give him an assignment. Tell him to solve a hypothetical problem. Construct an army only out of launchees. Maybe the soldiers on the transfer lists, too. I don't think there's any way to do that without telling him that we're onto his fake teacher login. So tell him. Then he won't believe anything he found while searching. He didn't find anything, said Graf. We didn't have to plant anything fake for him to find because he had his false theory. See? So whether he thinks we planted stuff or not, he'll stay deceived and we're still secure. You seem to be counting on your understanding of his psychology. Sister Carlotta assures me that he differs from ordinary human DNA in only one small area. So now he's human again? I've got to make decisions based on something, Dymac. So the jury's still out on the human thing? Get me a roster of the hypothetical army Bean would pick, so we can give it to Ender. He'll put himself in it, you know. He damn well better, or he's not as smart as we've been thinking. What about Ender? Is he ready? Anderson thinks he is. Graf sighed. To Bean, it's still just a game, because none of the weight has fallen on him yet. But Ender, I think he knows deep down where this is going to lead. I think he feels it already. Sir, just because you're feeling the weight doesn't mean he is. Graf laughed. You cut straight to the heart of things, don't you? Bean's hungry for it, sir. If Ender isn't, then why not put the burden where it's wanted? If Bean's hungry for it, it proves he's still too young. Besides, the hungry ones always have something to prove. Look at Napoleon. Look at Hitler. Bold at first, yes, but then still bold later on when they need to be cautious, to pull back. Patton, Caesar, Alexander, always overreaching, never quite putting the finish on it. No, it's Ender, not Bean. Ender doesn't want to do it, so he won't have anything to prove. Are you sure you're not just picking the kind of commander you'd want to serve under? That's precisely what I'm doing, said Graf. Can you think of a better standard? The thing is, you can't pass the buck on this one, can you? Can't say how it was the tests, you just followed the tests, the scores, whatever. Can't run this like a machine. That's why you don't want Bean, isn't it? Because he was made like a machine. I don't analyze myself. I analyze them. So, if we win, who really won the war? The commander you picked, or you for picking him? The triumvirate for trusting me, after their fashion. But if we lose, well, then it's definitely you. We're all dead, then. What will they do? Kill me first, or leave me till last so I can contemplate the consequences of my error? Ender, though, I mean, if he's the one, he won't say it's you. He'll take it all on himself. Not the credit for victory. Just the blame for failure. Win or lose, the kid I pick is going to have a brutal time of it.
Bean got his summons during lunch. He reported at once to Dymac's quarters. He found his teacher sitting at his desk, reading something. The light was set so that Bean couldn't read it through the dazzle. Have a seat, said Dymac. Bean jumped up and sat on Dymac's bed, his legs dangling. Let me read you something, said Dymac. There are no fortifications, no magazines, no strong points. In the enemy's solar system, there can be no living off the land, since access to habitable planets will be possible only after complete victory. Supply lines are not a problem, since there are none to protect. But the cost of that is that all supplies and ordnance must be carried with the invading fleet. In effect, all interstellar invasion fleets are suicide attacks, because time dilation means that even if a fleet returns intact, almost no one they knew will still be alive. They can never return, and so must be sure that their force is sufficient to be decisive and therefore is worth the sacrifice. Mixed-sex forces allow the possibility of the army becoming a permanent colony and/or occupying force on the captured enemy planet. Bean listened complacently. He had left it in his desk for them to find it, and they had done so. You wrote this, Bean, but you never submitted it to anybody. There was never an assignment that it fit. You don't seem surprised that we found it. I assume that you routinely scan our desks. Just as you routinely scan ours. Bean felt his stomach twist with fear. They knew. Cute, naming your false login graph with a carrot in front of it. Bean said nothing. You've been scanning all the other students' records. Why? I wanted to know them. I've only made friends with a few. Close friends with none. I'm little and I'm smarter than they are. Nobody's standing in line. So you use their records to tell you more about them. Why do you feel the need to understand them? Someday I'll be in command of one of these armies. Plenty of time to get to know your soldiers then. No, sir, said Bean. No time at all. Why do you say that? Because of the way I've been promoted. And Wigan. We're the two best students in this school and we're being raced through. I'm not going to have much time when I get an army. Bean, be realistic. It's going to be a long time before anybody's going to be willing to follow you into battle. Bean said nothing. He knew that this was false, even if Dymac didn't. Let's see just how good your analysis is. Let me give you an assignment. For which class? No class, Bean. I want you to create a hypothetical army. Working only with launchees, construct an entire roster, the full complement of 41 soldiers. No veterans? Bean meant the question neutrally, just checking to make sure he understood the rules. But Dymax seemed to take it as criticism of the unfairness of it. No, tell you what. You can include veterans who were posted for transfer at their commander's request. That'll give you some experienced ones. The ones the commander couldn't work with. Some really were losers, but some were the opposite. Fine, said Bean. How long do you think it will take you? Bean already had a dozen picked out. I can tell the list to you right now. I want you to think about it seriously. I already have. But you need to answer a couple of questions first. You said 41 soldiers, but that would include the commander. All right. 40, and leave the commander blank. I have another question. Am I to command the army? You can write it up that way if you want. But Dymax, very unconcerned, told Bean that the army was not for him. This army's for Wigan, isn't it? Dymax glowered. It's hypothetical. Definitely Wigan, said Bean. You can't boot somebody else out of command to make room for him, so you're giving Wigan a whole new army. I bet it's Dragon. Dymax looked stricken, though he tried to cover it. Don't worry, said Bean. I'll give him the best army you can form, following those rules. I said this was hypothetical. You think I wouldn't figure it out when I found myself in Wigan's army and everybody else in it was also on my roster? Nobody's said we're actually going to follow your roster. You will. Because I'll be right and you'll know it, said Bean. And I can promise you, it'll be a hell of an army. With Wigan to train us, we'll kick ass. Just do the hypothetical assignment and talk to no one about it. Ever. That was a dismissal, but Bean didn't want to be dismissed yet. They came to him. They were having him do their work. He wanted to have his say while they were still listening. The reason this army can be so good is that your system's been promoting a lot of the wrong kids. About half the best kids in this school are launchees or on the transfer lists, because they're the ones who haven't already been beaten into submission by the kiss-ass idiots you put in command of armies or toons. These misfits and little kids are the ones who can win. Wigan will figure that out. He'll know how to use us. Bean, you're not as smart about everything as you think you are. Yes, I am, sir, said Bean, or you wouldn't have given this assignment to me. May I be dismissed? Or do you want me to tell you the roster now? Dismissed, said Dymax. I probably shouldn't have provoked him, thought Bean. Now it's possible that he'll fiddle with my roster just to prove he can. But that's not the kind of man he is. If I'm not right about that, then I'm not right about anybody else either. Besides, it felt good to speak the truth to someone in power.